Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, a.k.a. Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy, high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Jay Hughes spoke at the 4th Alcor Conference on Life Extension Technologies, June 17, 2000. Dr. Jay addressed the topic of the future of death. Alcor is the largest organization in the world, arranging for the cryonic suspension of the apparently dead.
Last year, the Japanese police broke into a hotel room and discovered a group of cultists applying oils to the mummified body of their three-month-dead leader. They believed and asserted to the police that he was still alive. The Japanese police and the news media treated this as funny, and of course they were only charged with the mishandling of a corpse. But treating someone who is dead as if they are alive is almost as bad as treating someone who is alive as if they're dead. Given the gravity of these two potential errors, it's a wonder that there isn't a lot more public debate about the lines that we draw between life and death. Westerners hotly debate the lines that mark the beginning of life, largely ceded the debate about death to the medical establishment, who have been making it up as they go along for the last 40 years. I think all that will soon be changing. Genetic therapies, stem cells, and nanotechnology will soon be blowing the question of what is death wide open again. Now, I want to talk about four questions today. First, how will our concepts of death change in the coming decades and why? Will the cryonically suspended always be dead? Will people always have to be dead to get frozen? And will the reanimated always be considered the same person who was frozen? Now, to predict where death is going, I think we need to acknowledge the fundamental logic of Western ethical and political thought, liberal individualism. Liberal individualism asks why a sovereign, rational person should submit to authority, and it sees the development of the faculties of sovereign, rational people as the highest good and end. For our ethical tradition, subjective personhood is the beginning and the end. The expansion of suffrage and equal rights have been the slow clarification that rights adhere to subjective persons, not to races, sexes, or property. I believe we are currently in the final phase of the liberal democratic tradition's working out of its own internal ethical logic of the making of subjective personhood and gradations of consciousness up through and to personhood, the key to life, personal identity, and citizenship. The internal logic of Western ethics are the tracks, and biotechnology is the engine driving us down that track. There are a bunch of angry natives and bandits lying in ambush, but they are unlikely to derail the train. I'm not so worried about them as I am about the bridge that's out ahead. For unfortunately, I think technology will also eventually problematize life, personal identity, and citizenship in ways that unravel the assumptions of liberal democracy. And I'll get to that at the end of this talk. Now, just being, this is totally gratuitous animation here in this slide, but it's so cool, I had to do it. So, just as being male or white isn't relevant to whether a person should bear rights, so also simply having a human body is irrelevant. What matters is level of consciousness, such as whether the living can experience suffering, whether they are aware of themselves and their interests over time, and whether they have sufficient maturity to participate as a citizen of our society. Humans of various ages and degrees of cognitive disability can be arrayed along this continuum and roughly compared to animals of various kinds. At the end of the day, this model suggests that a second trimester human fetus should have the rights and social value of a sentient but simple animal like a fish. Permanently unconscious humans, lacking even sentience, have dropped below the threshold of moral concern altogether. The recent development of the history of death, of the definition of death, reflects the gradual acceptance of this schema. As respirators and intensive care units began to make it possible to keep the permanently unconscious alive, organ transplantation found a use for their organs. Removing vital organs from living people would be murder. As a result, physicians proposed that death be redefined to include brain death, leading eventually to the Presidential Bioethics Commission's recommendations in 1981 that states adopt a Uniform Declaration of Death Act, defining death as either the permanent cessation of respiration and circulation, that is the old standard, or as the irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem. 36 states have adopted this standard, and most others use a version of it. Before, during, and since the enacting of this whole brain standard, the vocal and substantial minority of a vocal and substantial minority of ethicists have argued for a less conservative standard, one more in line with the consciousness argument that I've just outlined, a standard that would define permanent unconsciousness as death. Permanent unconsciousness, as opposed to brain death, generally involves severe injury to the neocortex and not to the whole brain. Patients in this state are called PVS, or permanent vegetative state, and are similar in many respects to patients in end-stage dementia, with sleep-wake cycles and some movement, but no self-awareness. There also has been a persistent question about whether babies born without any brain above their brain stem, that is anencephalics, should be considered dead, so that their organs could be transplanted. Neocorticalists argue that since there will never be a self-aware personhood in cases of PVS and anencephaly, the patients are essentially dead. The whole brain standard was adopted as a compromise between these three camps: body death, the old standard, whole brain death, the new standard, and neocortical death, the proposed standard. The whole brain death standard was presented to the neocorticalists as a conservative version of their standard. If the whole brain is dead, there can be no possibility of recovery of consciousness. For the body death advocates, it was argued that the death of the whole brain destroyed autonomic processes and would lead inexorably to the cessation of respiration and circulation. Whole brain death was simply, therefore, an extension of the previous standard. But the whole brain death standard was a doomed definition from the start. Diagnostic procedures for determining complete cessation of all brain functions have been inconsistent and internally incoherent. In practice and in New Jersey by law, physicians often defer to family beliefs about death. Generally, patients have been declared brain dead while there is still some remaining brain activity, some remaining electrical activity in the brain. Not according to the standard that should be used, but in practice, in many places, people are declared brain dead. In practice, in many places, people are still declared brain dead while there could be electrical activity, and there is, in fact, sometimes electrical activity in parts of the brain. Recent longitudinal studies have demonstrated that once the brain dead are stabilized, they can survive for 10 years or more. That is, that much of the presumed inevitability of their biological death was, in fact, a process of stabilizing them in an intensive care setting, making up for the destroyed parts of the brain stem. The most serious challenge, however, is the rapidly changing boundaries and meaning of irreversibility. In Pittsburgh, in 1993, transplant surgeons began having families enlist their permanently unconscious and ventilator-dependent, but not brain-dead, wards in an experimental protocol. The patients are wheeled into an operating theater and removed from the respirator. The surgeons wait for cardiac arrest, then 2 minutes longer, and then begin prepping the body for the removal of organs. The surgeons argue that the patient is dead on the grounds that although, as with do not resuscitate orders, the patient could be revived, the patient's condition is in fact irreversible because family and surgeons have decided not to revive them. This allows them to stay within the dead donor rule: thou shalt only remove vital organs from the dead. These bodies are called non-heartbeating donor cadavers. The protocol is now in use in dozens of transplant centers and has stirred considerable debate and rethinking. The National Academy of Sciences has addressed an entire consensus volume to the procedure And parenthetically, it should be of some interest to cryonicists, since the Academy held that it is ethically acceptable to insert cannula and anticoagulants into the organ donor before they are dead, even though these procedures are not therapeutic and may hasten death, but will just help in the organ transplantation. In response to the NHBD debate, central figures in the brain death debate, such as Norm Faust and Stuart Youngner, and notably Linda Emanuel, who is the chief ethics attorney at the AMA, have been calling for an end to death redefinition, which they now consider a meaningless semantic game. Instead, they argue we should simply figure out the different decisions that need to be made about dying and dead people, permanently unconscious, maybe dead enough to take organs, but cessation of respiration should probably be the standard for dead enough to get cremated, since we're so uncomfortable with the idea of cremating people who are still breathing. They would, as a result, repeal the dead donor rule, legitimating organ removal as a legitimate measure to kill otherwise living people. The impetus to junk the binary dead-alive ethics for a graduated continuum of rights key to neurological status will be getting an even stronger push in the coming decades from at least three directions. The ability to repair brain damage and even brain death, and I'll talk in a second about fetal rights and then species. First with brain death. I assume this crowd is pretty well aware of the advances in stem cells, neurotissue regeneration, and neural silicon interfaces. Suffice it to say that patients with severe brain injuries will soon be treated with combinations of chemical, genetic, transplant, and mechanical therapies to restore them to self-awareness. I'll talk in a moment about their status. But these techniques will push us further towards a consciousness-based ethical standard and away from the old death definitions. Similarly, since Roe v. Wade, fetal rights have been largely determined by a concept of fetal viability assigned by the Supreme Court in 1973 to be the third trimester. But neonatal intensive care technology now makes it possible to rescue miscarriages as early as 5 months gestation. I use rescue lightly, because some, of course, don't consider it rescue. Research being done on artificial amniotic fluid and artificial wombs will push the boundary back even further. So long as fetuses are inside women, bodily autonomy claims trump fetal rights. But once the fetus is decanted, its evolving claims to independent rights will be based on an assessment of its changing neurological status, ability to experience pain, and self-awareness. Last year, Jeremy Rifkin filed a patent on human-animal chimera and got the patent office to acknowledge that, even though it has issued many patents on living things, it is illegal to patent a human being, to own a human being, and the federal government still has not determined what a human being is. Similarly, the Great Ape Project has convinced New Zealand to forbid experimentation on great apes because they are too similar to humans cognitively. I believe that eventually the technological blurring of species barriers and the movement for animal rights will force a species-independent definition of living things' rights, one presumably based on cognitive complexity. Now, I'm not a total technological determinist. These changes will not come easily, and I believe that they will be one of the fundamental political divisions in the coming years, which I refer to as biofundamentalism versus transhumanism, cutting across left and right. As demonstrated by the controversy that now swirls around Peter Singer, a bioethicist at Princeton, who has advocated these positions, passions will be very high. Liberal application of the proposed standard could allow some consequences that many consider yucky. And yucky is a professional bioethics term, by the way. Such as intentionally decerebrate or anencephalic transplant clones, euthanasia of newborns and the severely demented, and more rights for some animals than for some humans. But I believe the tangible benefits of the new standard, even more than its consistency with Western thought, will win out. Now, given this proposed and, I think, inevitable redefinition, will the frozen always be dead? Alcor has staked out a pretty extreme position on the proper definition of death, and that is the irreversible loss of the structural information which encodes memory and personality should be considered death. I think the principal question faced by that definition is whether potential persons should ever be treated as actual persons. An embryo encodes the information for a potential self-aware person, just as frozen brain tissue does. But should that potential be treated with actuality, even if the likelihood of becoming a person is very low? For instance, next year in 2001, when HAL sends Frank Poole spinning off into interstellar space, would his quick frozen brain still be alive, even if it was never retrieved? If it got sucked into a wormhole and floated in intergalactic space until the heat death of the universe, why would we want to consider that a state of life? Clearly, the frozen do not meet a consciousness-based definition of life based on continuous waking sentience, much less self-aware personhood. On the other hand, if such a standard is applied too rigidly, people who are in deep sleep, who are hypothermically suspended but revivable, or who have been placed in temporary therapeutic states of arrest would also be considered dead. We want to continue to treat some non-sentient potential persons as alive. So which ones? And by the way, if you're worried about Frank Poole, he is revived in 3001 using nanotechnology. You can read that in Arthur C. Clarke's sequel.
You're listening to Dr. J address the topic The Future of Death at the 4th Alcor Conference on Life Extension Technologies, June 17th, 2000, in Asilomar, California, on Change Surfer Radio.
The degree to which a potential person is treated as an actual living person is a function of two things: the likelihood that they can become a person again, and the degree to which socially legitimated decision makers want them to be treated as persons. And here I'm not talking about what the definition of death should be according to Alcor or the people in this room, but what it is likely to be socially and politically in the coming decades. Fetuses are not persons, but are treated as persons if they will be brought to term, as patients. But they are not treated as patients if they are so disabled that they will not survive or they are to be aborted. People in cardiac arrest are treated as living persons to be revived unless they're sick, and they'll never return to consciousness, or they and their decision makers don't want them revived. Now, under probate law, missing persons are declared dead, although they may be potentially still alive somewhere, if there is pretty good evidence that they aren't coming back, and somebody is motivated to get them declared dead. Otherwise, they're considered dead after 5 to 7 years of absence. Presumably, the intention of cryonauts' guardians to revive them and to treat them as patients will remain pretty clear. But the degree to which society will treat the frozen as having some rights or claim on society will depend on their likelihood of return. The likelihood that the brain damaged and frozen, and these, I think these two categories will be closely linked, can return will depend on two things: the amount of brain information irretrievably lost and the technology available to repair and restore the damaged neural tissue, what we've just been discussing. Once we begin repairing the brains and the permanently unconscious and brain dead, we will likely shift to a definition of death something like, quote, the patient is dead if they are unlikely to be revivable to self-awareness with continuity of previous memories and personality because they have lost that information or we cannot retrieve it or they or their guardians do not wish them to be revived. And I say with continuity of previous memories because if we're able to give people entirely new brain tissue to make up for the brain tissue that was destroyed, but it does not include any of the identity that was there before, we have a problem, which I'll get to in a second. Having already been declared dead, a frozen person, like the missing person, is dead until proven otherwise. That is, until there is successful reanimation, I presume. As society comes to believe reanimation is possible, the status and rights of the cryo-suspended will gradually increase. Halperin in The First Immortal depicts this quite well. People may not be charged with murder for malicious thawing, but it will become an increasingly serious offense. Elaborating on a suggestion from Ettinger, he proposes in The First Immortal that the law could recognize four categories of corpses, from those that were completely destroyed to the ideally preserved. So is being dead necessarily a problem? When you're dead, you can't own property, but you also don't have to pay taxes. You can donate your body to Alcor for storage, but you could have decided to be treated at Alcor if you were considered alive. You can use estate mechanisms to determine your posthumous affairs, but you could have used your rights as a citizen to determine your affairs if you were considered alive. You can use life insurance money to fund your suspension, but you could have put that money into a suspension trust to be drawn from if you were alive. Correct me if I'm wrong, anyone who's an estate planner. Your spouse can remarry if you're dead, but our laws against bigamy are probably very stupid anyway, and I hope we'll someday be taken off the books. You can't vote if you're dead outside of Illinois, but how informed could your choices be? Predictable joke, but... how informed could your choices be when you're frozen, in any case? The principal reason cryonicists are concerned about the definition of their status is because many would like to get frozen before they are legally dead. They'd like to have being frozen not be considered a state of death, because if it's considered a state of death, getting frozen is considered assisted suicide. They wanted to be seen as emergent care. You wanted to be seen as emergent care as opposed to suicide. So will people always have to be dead to get frozen? Probably not. So long as being frozen is considered dead, helping to freeze someone not already dead will be considered assisted suicide, as was made clear in the Donaldson case here in California. So the ability to freeze folks pre-mortem depends on legalizing a very liberal set of acceptable modes of assisted suicide. Fortunately, the majority of Americans have supported and continue to support a right to assisted suicide. This graph shows support for the statement, when a person, since 1947, I mark, when a person has a disease that cannot be cured, do you think doctors should be allowed by law to end the patient's life by some painless means if the patient and his family request it? And a majority of Americans have said yes for 25 years. So why don't we have assisted suicide laws yet? Fortunately, the influence of right-to-life Christian groups and conservative doctors is now being fought by increasingly successful Choice in Dying organizations, who have succeeded in putting a number of assisted suicide laws on the ballot in a number of states and passing an assisted suicide law in Oregon. While the Supreme Court did not sadly rule that assisted suicide is a constitutional right in 1997, and there were two separate constitutional arguments for why it should be, it did rule that states are pretty free to legalize assisted suicide if they so choose. The liberalization of assisted suicide may not come as quickly as Halperin predicts in The First Immortal, in which President Gore celebrates Jack Kevorkian with a fireworks display this coming January. But I think it is safe to predict that boomers will be increasingly concerned about ensuring choice in dying in the coming three decades. Of course, once there's been a successful reanimation, suspension will be seen as an experimental treatment option. The acceptability of an experimental treatment increases with the risk as the risk of mortality declines. However, by the time reanimation is possible and the risk of mortality from it low, as was suggested by an earlier question, I think, presumably far fewer people will need to make use of such an extreme step. So by the time the frozen are considered alive, no one will want to get frozen anymore. Now, a couple words about the definition of a successful reanimation. In an era of neuroremediation, we will constantly face the question of the meaning of putting back together a living person who has lost all identity-critical information. Will we say that a person is identical to the previous person with their rights and obligations, or should they be considered a new person? Alcor has already forewarned cryonauts of this possibility. Until brain cryopreservation can be reversed, it cannot be known for certain that cryonic suspension successfully preserves long-term memory and identity. It is possible, and with suboptimal suspension even likely, that they will wake with various degrees of amnesia. In particularly bad cases, cell and tissue repair technology might only result in revival of a biological twin of the suspended patient. Nanotechnological assessment of the degree of information loss should be pretty good at predicting the likelihood of successful restoration of memory and personality. If recovery is unlikely, the person's advanced directives or surrogate decision makers will need to determine whether it should be attempted in any case, even if the result is a new person. Once the person is revived, I imagine that they will still need to be assessed for whether they do in fact meet the continuity requirement. But if there is a new person, they will have a pretty strong claim to squatter's rights. Finally, the coming train wreck. Our ethical and political tradition is based on continuous, discrete, autonomous selves. And those are, in my view, unfortunately, an affliction. As Ettinger wrote in The Prospect of Immortality, The simplest conclusion is that there really is no such thing as individuality in any profound sense. Let us then cut the Gordian knot by recognizing that identity, like morality, is man-made, relative, rather than natural and absolute. We have degrees of identity, said Ettinger. Just as technology drives us to clarify that we value continuous, discrete, self-aware persons more than the platforms that they come on, so it will also force us to acknowledge that those persons are fictions. In particular, technology threatens the boundaries and continuity of the self, the autonomy of the individual and their decisions, and the fiction of social equality between individuals. I'm just going to very briefly, and you can ask me questions to elaborate on these ideas if you like, very briefly talk about some of these threats. And I believe Greg is going to talk in the next talk about uploading as a potential future technology, and this is really where I think this rubber hits the road. But the threats will develop in many areas, and they're already with us in many different ways. Our control over the brain will slowly make clear that cognition, memory, and personal identity are actually many processes that can be disaggregated. We will have increasing control over our own personalities and memories, and those of our children. Full nano-replication of the mental process, of the kind that Greg, I think, will talk about, opens the possibility of identity cloning, distributing one's identity over multiple platforms, sharing of mental components with others, and the merging of several individuals into one identity. And let me just close by telling you a brief joke, which I think illustrates this well. A man in Dublin began to order and drink 3 beers each time he entered his local pub, making the natives very curious. Eventually, the barkeep asked him why. The man said it was because he had a brother in Chicago and another in Los Angeles, and they had vowed to always drink 3 beers to remember one another. The barkeep, and then the rest of Dublin, was greatly impressed with his act of devotion, but one day the man came in and only ordered 2 beers. The barkeep was saddened and offered his condolences. The man was puzzled and then said, "You'll be happy to know my 2 brothers are both alive, but I myself have given up drinking for Lent." In conclusion, I wanted to say very briefly, I want you to mix it up with the bioethicists. While preparing for this talk, I discovered that cryonicists have been well ahead of the bioethicists on defining death for decades. For instance, in neither of last year's volume, The Definition of Death, which had 25 essays by leading authorities on brain death, no one in that entire volume addressed the question of emerging technologies and their implications for the definition of brain death. And none of the conference papers at March's International Meeting of the Network for the Definition of Death addressed emerging technologies. So I'm the list master and webmaster for the network. I invite you to go to the website, join the discussion on the list, have copies of my slides in the back, and I can send you copies of the paper if you sign up in the back as well, and I have cards back there as well. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Jay Hughes speak at the 4th Alcor Conference on Life Extension Technologies, June 17, 2000. Dr. Jay addressed the topic of the future of death. Alcor is the largest organization in the world, arranging for the cryonic suspension of the apparently dead. For more information on cryonics, visit the Alcor site at www.alcor.org. For more information on the definition of death, visit the International Network for the Definition of Death at www.changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.